My name is Gary Carrion Mariari, and I'm one of the curators of the exhibition NYC 1993 Experimental Jet Set Trash and No Star. This exhibition brings together works by over 75 artists. All of the works in the show were either made or shown in New York over the course of the year 1993. The exhibition does not focus on a single theme or a united group of artists. Instead, it is organized as kind of a time capsule, showing the diverse artistic approaches and the range of issues and ideas that were discussed and debated in the New York art world and abroad. NYC 1993 includes artworks by New York artists who were just emerging at that particular moment and have since become well-known internationally. It also includes works by older artists who made some of their most iconic and challenging works in 1993. We've also included works by artists not from New York, who had some of their first notable exhibitions in New York over the course of that year. 1993 was a pivotal year in the New York art world, when art intersected with both politics and popular culture. Many of the works in the exhibition, especially those dealing with social issues like racial politics and gender and sexuality, were initially very controversial and heavily criticized. In the 20 years since 1993, these issues have only become more pressing, and many of the works are now regarded as vital artistic contributions to these critical debates. The exhibition takes its subtitle, Experimental Jet Set Trash and No Star, from an album by the New York City rock band Sonic Youth, which was recorded in the city that year. Its title evokes the tension between the mainstream and the underground. In this way, we've selected artists for the show that represent both the well-known and the overlooked, works that were both shown in major museums and ones that were initially only seen by a small audience. The exhibition is a result of both archival research and discussions with artists, curators, critics, and other participants in the New York art world at that moment. It's not meant to be a definitive history of art of the 1990s, but instead a subjective portrait of a time and place that continues to shape art making today. For this audio guide, we've gone back to original reviews of the included works and artists, articles published in Art in America, Art Forum, The Village Voice, and other periodicals offer insight into the way these works were received in their original context. Read by New Museum staff, docents, and volunteers, these reviews recall the concerns, biases, and urgencies of New York's art world in 1993.
The following text is taken from Eleanor Heaney's review of the exhibition Jessica Diamond at American Fine Art, printed in the February 1993 issue of Art in America. In its second coming in the 80s and 90s, conceptual art tends to adopt a more accessible and didactic tone than it assumed in its first incarnation in the 60s and 70s. The work of Jessica Diamond is a case in point, melding the anti-commodity stance of conceptualism with the polemical approach of today's political art. She creates works which take aim at the mythologizing of art and artists. Her mode of attack is to parody complex thought systems through crudely posed dichotomies and diagrams. The tone of her works is deadpan, the look deliberately anti-style. Many of the pieces in this show consisted of words and diagrams painted directly on the wall. They frequently have elaborate titles, which in some cases are much longer than the simple texts that constitute the works themselves. The format recalls the work of Lawrence Wiener, but instead of cryptic philosophical commentary, Diamond's wall paintings run to quips and slogans.
The following text is taken from an exhibition listing printed in the June 29, 1993 issue of The Village Voice. This German artist's antibody paintings, numbers 1 through 5, are all over fields of layered molecular chaos and buried cartoon imagery coagulating into a vast inhuman grin. Recalling both Polk and Scharf, they're weird enough, particularly the impossibly green one with radiant light, to make one wonder what will come next.
The following text is taken from Stephen Westfall's review of the exhibition Kerry James Marshall at Jack Shaman, printed in the October 1993 issue of Art in America. In the shallow, stage-like spaces of Kerry James Marshall's large, unstretched canvases, black men and women pose in turn with a majestic sense of inner stillness. Their faces are wide-eyed and solemn, even when they are smiling. The air around them buzzes with signs, voodoo hex symbols, musical staves with snatches of song lyrics, and the flames of votive candles, all hovering like ghosts of cultural memories. Marshall's is from Los Angeles, where he might have encountered the elegant paintings of Raymond Saunders, whose fragmented spaces and fluidly brushed colors yield sharp little clues to the African-American experience. Marshall is also the production manager for the trance-inducing film Daughters of the Dust. Clearly, he knows how to weave a visual spell while invoking a social conscience, but his work moves on a level far deeper than even that of empathy for the African-American psyche. There's something about the figures themselves, their knowingness. As in Frida Kahlo's self-portraits, these figures appear consciously to inhabit their fate. This is a quality that especially charismatic screen actors occasionally suggest, but painting hasn't been concerned with character or fate for some time. The poetic generalization of Marshall's figures serves to extend the sense of deepened self-consciousness to an entire people. As Marshall's protagonists observe us across the gulf of their displacement, their smallest actions and inflections of expression seem touched by myth. We are reminded that in myth, the road to soulfulness passes through exile and loss, and that heroes rarely volunteer. These paintings succeed where much of the drearily issue-oriented work of the last few years fails. They replenish the world's depleted store of compassion and its mythic dimension.
The following text is taken from Faye Hirsch's review of the exhibition Frank Moore at Spironi Westwater, printed in the April 1993 issue of Art in America. Frank Moore at Spironi Westwater. Recent articles and reviews in these pages have testified to the art community's continuing preoccupation with AIDS. Painting, however, is less frequently the medium of choice for visual artists addressing the issue than our endeavors that draw upon the mass media. Frank Moore recently showed a group of paintings that powerfully contradict this tendency. Moore has remained faithful over the years to political themes, but in these new works, his meticulous figuration is particularly effective in conveying, above all, the overwhelming impact of the disease. For people with AIDS, for those who love and care for PWAs, or for those who militate politically for them. Sober indeed are these ambitious paintings, brightly colored but dark in spirit. While I might quibble with certain aspects of the installation, the step-like hanging of the works in the back gallery, for instance, interfered with their already demanding presence, nothing detracts from the passion with which these paintings express the brutal toll of this disease.
That especially charismatic screen actors occasionally suggest, but painting hasn't been concerned with character or fate for some time. The poetic generalization of Marshall's figures serves to extend the sense of deepened self-consciousness to an entire people. As Marshall's protagonists observe us across the gulf of their displacement, their smallest actions and inflections of expression seem touched by myth. We are reminded that in myth, the road to soulfulness passes through exile and loss, and that heroes rarely volunteer. These paintings succeed where much of the drearily issue-oriented work of the last few years fails. They replenish the world's depleted store of compassion and its mythic dimension.
The following text is taken from Peter Sheldahl's review of the exhibition Andre Serrano at Paula Cooper Gallery, printed in the February 16, 1993 issue of The Village Voice. Andre Serrano's pretty death photographs are so brazenly strategic, they're beyond manipulative. The calculations practically line up with arrows pointing at them. First the subject, corpses in a morgue, eek. Then the medium, state-of-the-art Cibachrome in 4x5-foot prints, silicone bonded to plexiglass, wow. Then the form, close-ups of body details composed like painted still lifes with black backgrounds and washes of studio-type, often gel-colored lighting, swoon. Finally, the content, ambiguous, you decide. Tips for deciding might be found in a fashionably disaffected compendium of received ideas, as for instance, Americans, you know, those people, deny death, unlike us. Once you start looking at these things, it is hard to stop. You know the subjects don't mind. The dead are infinitely obliging models, and Serrano reciprocates by focusing on their most interesting, if not exactly flattering, features. His relentless aestheticizing diffuses the psychic mechanism of identification, that could be me, or that could be my loved one, which can make pictures of the dead particularly unbearable. Liberated from fear and pity, contemplation may attain the dubious courage of Schadenfreude. They're dead. I'm not. I do not like this show, though it seems entirely successful on its own terms, which are incidentally the terms of an honored gallery striving to regain avant-garde-ish cachet. Such cachet depends on mounting shows that abruptly reveal the aesthetic cogency and naturally the marketability of things previously more or less unthinkable. Cooper has done handsomely with and for Serrano. Given the task of validating a truly iffy artistic premise, the gallery's architectural grace and institutional dignity seem more than usually luminous. The show's an object lesson in what New York gallery culture is all about. It's just that now and then I tire of New York gallery culture.
The following text is taken from an exhibition listing printed in the November 16, 1993 issue of the Village Voice. Mike Kelly, opening with a wall of garbage drawings and a vast crocheted afghan under which lurks an extended family of primal lumps, the survey adds to Kelly's reputation for naughty boy glory. It also reveals him as a latter-day conceptualist, a deconstructor of pathetic fallacies and the phallic imagination, an excremental philosopher exploring the realm of male sexual identity and all its polymorphous perversity. From the whoopee cushion sculpture of the 70s to the orphaned and abused cuddly toys, the work is hilarious, horrendous, silly, profound, and remarkably consistent in its core concerns. Through February 20th, Whitney Museum of American Art.
The following text is taken from Ken Johnson's review of the exhibition Paul McCarthy at Luring Augustine, printed in the May 1993 issue of Art in America. Legendary performance extremist Paul McCarthy is notorious for doing shocking, crazy, appallingly gross things in order to break through the decorum of ordinary consciousness. As this exhibition proved, however, McCarthy is also an engaging and original entertainer. The show included two works, an hour-long 1991 video of the artist dressed in a clown outfit, giving a kind of demented cooking lesson, and a mechanized sculptural tableau involving a man, a boy, and a goat. McCarthy's other piece, a new work called Cultural Gothic, presents three life-size robotic figures, a short, stout, middle-aged man with a face cast from life, a boy, about 9 years old, with the face of a mannequin. Man and boy are neatly dressed, suburban style, and a stuffed goat with its hindquarters positioned in front of the boy's hips. Periodically, the figures go through a sequence of mechanical movements. The boy looks inquiringly at the man nods, whereupon the boy flexes his pelvis in a sexual motion, lifting the goat's rump up and down. On the surface, this was delightful puppetry and a droll, dirty joke. It also had deeper psychological implications, being a kind of father-son initiation scene. Of course, ostensibly such ritualized initiatory moments don't actually happen in mainstream American culture, but perhaps at some unconscious level they do. In any case, it's the way McCarthy renders visible normally covered-up levels of psychic experience that makes his art something more than just gratuitously provocative shock theater.
The following text is taken from Patricia C. Phillips' review of the exhibition Ida Appelbrug at the Brooklyn Museum, printed in the October 1993 issue of Art Forum. Appelbrug offered no easy resolution of the various elements of her disquieting installation, but the piece suggested that global, local, and domestic phenomena, which originate in ostensibly circumscribed settings, are all potentially subject to the abuses of power. This work is not a reflexive response, nor is it a plaintive gesture. Rather, it transcends obvious sloganeering. In fact, Applebrook makes no appeal at all. In her enigmatic but tenacious representations of violence, she simply provides a practiced, skeptical view of the interdependence of contemporary environments.
The following text is taken from Elizabeth Hess's review of the exhibition Nicole Eisenman at Elizabeth Corey, printed in the March 23, 1993 issue of The Village Voice. There are bodies or corpses everywhere in Nicole Eisenman's work, none of them the least bit unformed or abstract. Eisenman wants us to wallow in the muck of our own unconscious and conscious thoughts until we drown. And she's not throwing out any life preservers. Her small show of 19 seething drawings, all gouache on paper, makes us want to see more. Unlike McCarty, Eisenman doesn't want to set our imaginations free. She spells out every specific for us, making sure we get her point. She asks us to dump our preconceived notions of sexuality and go with her to a place where gender is twisted until it hurts, and people seem to bleed a lot. Violence lurks just beneath the surface of every frame, unless, of course, the end of the world as we know it is already in progress. In Eisenman's world, women do not seek revenge on the opposite sex. They've already taken it. Eisenman's crowd scenes are extraordinary, but she is at her most brilliant when transforming an ordinary scene into a nightmare. A straightforward drawing of a baseball player, worthy of Norman Rockwell, becomes a scathing comment on gender bending. The hand that throws the ball has a set of red manicured nails. A family sits down at a breakfast table that might as well belong to the Cleavers until Mom opens her blouse to squirt some milk into her son's bowl. Oops, there's blood coming out of her breast. Eisenman wants us to gag, and she's toxic enough to choke us. Her drawings harness the power of Sue Coe to the craziness of R. Crumb, all in the service of the most politically incorrect feminism to date.
The following text is taken from Peter Sheldahl's review of the 1993 Whitney Biennial, printed in the March 16, 1993 issue of The Village Voice. Four visits to this biennial have left me grouchy. I dislike the show quite a bit, though with a feeling tempered, or maybe just beaten down, by the evident indifference in so much of the work on view to whether I or anyone else likes it or not. Many of the artists pointedly forego mere pleasure in favor of proving psychosocial ills, carrying torches for aggrieved communities, and otherwise politicking. The main emphasis falls on otherwise, a blanketing aura of vaguely angry, fuzzily pretentious, worldly concern amounting to a generational style, or style substitute. The show breathes an anxiety of young artists to be perceived as on the right side of some cultural war or another. Meanwhile, there is Charles Ray, who alone seems equal to be inflated level of public expectation that burdens this biennial. Ray's flair for sheer crowd-pleasing is nothing if not tactful. Given his simultaneous communication of subversively alienated soulfulness, the emotion of a bitterly powerless child's boundless fantasies of power. You get to choose how deeply, beyond superficial amusement, you will be drawn into his work's wild core. Now that's public art, engaging for everybody while maintaining the truth to private experience without which art is a mistake. It tells me to stick around for the further development of a so far pretty discouraging zeitgeist.
The following text is taken from Elizabeth Hess's review of the 1993 Whitney Biennial, printed in the March 16, 1993 issue of the Village Voice. I'm delighted to report that this year's Whitney Biennial is not dead. It's not a brilliant show, but it's an ambitious one that actually goes so far as to take a stand on what is consequential in contemporary art. Organizing the biennial may be the most thankless task the art world offers, but curator Elizabeth Sussman, working with other Whitney curators, Thelma Golden, John G. Hanhart, and Lisa Phillips, has assembled an exhibition that addresses concrete issues. The work is uneven, but there are enough smashing objects to make the show worthwhile. I'm not unhappy to report that feminists steal the show this year. Maureen Connor and Xu Li Zhang have video installations that should not be missed. The third floor has an entire feminist section where one can view Nancy Sparrow, Sue Williams, and Cindy Sherman's In a Collective Rage. Four of Sherman's most difficult photographs are included in this biennial. Although they are somewhat hidden at the back of a floor, they are amazing and disruptive wherever they hang. Sherman's horrifying couple, Mr. Penis and Ms. Vagina, managed to capture decades of brutal sexual antagonism at a glance. She signals the end of sex as we know it, without so much as a hint of optimism.
Wonderful.
The following text is taken from Francesco Bonomi's review of the exhibition Felix Gonzalez Torres at Andrea Rosen, printed in the November-December 1993 issue of Flash Art. They are few, but in times of transformation they play the leading role within a community trying to redefine its past and face a looming and uncertain future. I am talking about the so-called echo people, those who don't act but rather listen to the community, any community, including that of artists. Felix Gonzalez Torres is one of those rare echoes. His latest show is a vision of grief, intuition, a response to the sound of life, trying to figure out to whom and to why we must pay our debt for living. Travel Number One is the title given to the front room of the exhibition. Bare light bulbs hang from the ceiling in a corner. Untitled, A Couple, 1993, the only sources of light for the space. Two gallery walls are turned into a life-size experience by virtue of a black-and-white photograph of the sky with a gliding bird, an experience that can only be shared by the presence of the other. The two strings of the light bulbs falling one over the other provide the only brightness our eyes can offer to the sky above us. Under, down below, beside someone or even no one, save for the bodies we've laid down with, or looked up into the sky with, following the flight of that one bird, unknown, yet as meaningful as all the others, we do not know. And then, the drawings, untitled, Bloodworks, Steady Decline, 1993, simple reminders, the lights soon turned off, eyes closed, no bird in the air, no bodies in the grass, a decline, art as the intuition of life, not a celebration, but the acceptance of the weakness of each identity under the sky. We are down, the body feels the cold ground, our minds follow the gray sky. We never really learn how to live, yet nobody ever taught us a better and less painful way out.
The following text is taken from Elizabeth Hess's review of the New Museum exhibition, The Final Frontier, printed in the June 15, 1993 issue of The Village Voice. There is not much to see in this show, which is ultimately its downfall, but there are things to do. You can play computer games, answer phones, stroke the fur of a dead dog. Sound like fun? Not. Curator Alice Wang, working with critics Lisa Cartwright and Celeste Olaquiaga, selected a somewhat off-putting group of objects that attempts to describe the impact of the technological progress on our bodies, not to mention our minds. While articulate essays in a handout explain curatorial ambitions, what we see initially is a puzzling assemblage of austere objects, photographs, and monitors. It is as if the new museum decided to probe the implications of RoboCop, leaving out the robotics. Something is missing from this show, and I fear it is the best part. Hollywood cyborgs are born in part to delight, while the show offers few pleasures. The mediums run from Macs to a video monitor hanging from the ceiling, playing surveillance tapes from an adult daycare center. Older women shuffle back and forth to tables or to nowhere. Julia Scherer's Mothers Under Surveillance describes the poverty of these limited lives, but fails to make any intervention into this world. She just asks us to watch, along with all the other watchers. A number of pieces address the notion of technology in the wrong hands, asking the question, who's watching whom, but rarely is an enemy targeted.
The following text is taken from Anastasius Ackman's review of the exhibition Gary Simmons at Metro Pictures, printed in December 1993 issues of Art News. This recent exhibition calls to mind a quote attributed to the jazz drummer Max Roach. Hip-hop lives in the world, not in the world of music, and that is why it is so revolutionary. Gary Simmons' brightly colored, vibrant works draw their energy directly from local street life, graffiti, and slang. The 29-year-old artist appeals to the personal and familiar, to raise questions about the communities around us and the world at large. The 12 large paintings on canvas tarp in this show were inspired by, if not directly lifted from, the scenic backdrops frequently stenciled with phrases set up by portraitists on 42nd and 125th Streets. For photographs of families and friends, Simmons titles many of his works according to the phrases he used in the pictures, such as Original Man and Time for Some Action. African pride is another common street theme, represented here by the green, red, and black stripes of roots and the African textile pattern that constitutes the background for the silhouetted black woman in The Nubian Queen. Like the portraitist, Simmons took his finished canvases out of the streets and photographed passers-by in the front of the backdrop of their choice. One entire wall of the gallery was covered in 765 Polaroids, taken in Bedford-Stuyvesant in Harlem. Predictably, father and son duos often chose the Original Man, while teenage girls were drawn into The Nubian Queen, and young boys to Scope, a bright green canvas depicting the circles of crosshairs of guns. Trademark Simmons touches, such as cartoons, characters, are missing entirely from his work. This interferes very little with the hip-hop aesthetic, perhaps to make the work of his work as accessible as possible. The installation creates an almost overwhelming sense of community, a momentary vision of solidarity, and hope in a time of complex social identities, continuing racism and alienation from our neighbors.
The following text is taken from Arlene Raven's review of the exhibition Mary Beth Edelson, A Non-Survey in Two Parts, 1973 through 1993, at Nicole Klagsbrunn, printed in the March 9, 1993 issue of The Village Voice. Edelson's newest images look frightening mad. A still shot of an actor, Gina Rollins, from the film Gloria, makes a frontal attack on the viewer. Firepower emanates from the eyes of the glamorous blonde, whose gun, in drastic perspective, seems welded to her head. The shooter, repeated and applied to a ruffled bedspread for two, lies in wait
for an assailant or a mark. The battle between the sexes, a struggle exemplified by confrontations such as the defeat of Bobby Riggs by tennis great Billie Jean King, has its origin with the beginning of both 19th and 20th century waves of the women's movement. This battle is called up symbolically as combat embodied in the female soldier, but the battleground remains the bed, identified with the passive, unconscious female, and in which a woman must still lie.